This is the You Can Learn Chinese podcast, part of the Seneca Network from The China Project. For everyone who's trying to learn Chinese or reaching for the next level, you came to the right place. I am your host, Jared Turner, longtime resident of China, co-founder of the Mandarin Companion Graded Reader Series, and my potted cactus diet. So I'm officially less nurturing than the desert. My co-host is John Passon, co-founder of Mandarin Companion, founder of All Set Learning, the Chinese Grammar Wiki, Sinospice.com, and as John always says, education is important, but big muscles is importanter. Many people study for the HSK exam, but will focusing your language learning on your interests and needs be better and faster for you? Well, yes, maybe. In this episode, John and I are going to discuss how to bring better focus to your studies so you can beat the pants off HSK. Guest interview is with Ben Whatley. Is it Whatley? Whately. I'm going to say it both ways, okay? Guest interview is with Ben Whatley, avid Chinese learner and co-founder of Memrise Language Learning Platform. Let's get to it. Hey guys, this is Jared Turner coming at you from Utah in the United States.
Hey everybody, my name is John Passon and I am in Shanghai, China. How's it going?
All right, John, before we kick into things, we do have a couple of reviews. Do you want to lead us off?
All right, this one's from Chris via Apple Podcasts in Taiwan, and he says, learn Chinese the right way, 5 stars. I have been studying Chinese a number of years here in China. This podcast has finally put my experiences into words. If you're a newcomer to Chinese or just someone who likes to self-study, these guys give amazing advice which will save you time, money, and effort in the long run. Keep on going. Thanks, Chris.
Awesome. Our other review comes from Renee in the United States. She says, be ready to be inspired. I didn't think a podcast talking about language learning would be as helpful as listening to the actual language, but has been truly inspiring. This podcast is filled with helpful information. I hesitate to call them tips as well. I've only listened to about 7 or 8 episodes, but they've all been highly motivating. The studies they review or conduct themselves are so informative, and the interviews are so fascinating. Since listening, I've started meeting with a friend who is a native speaker, and she has been very encouraging to practice conversation with. I also totally get the point of view about reading characters in context through reading a Mandarin Companion book. Only in chapter 2, and I already have noticed an increase in my confidence to read. Thanks, you too. Well, thank you, Renee. We really appreciate that. And hey, keep those studies going.
Yeah, that is awesome. We definitely cannot replace, you know, native speaker input, but we hope we can help you with your studies for sure.
All right, John, what if I were to come to you and say, hey, passing the HSK 3, 4, or 5, is that a good goal? What would you say?
Well, I would say it's better than no goal because, you know, goals are useful, but just kind of randomly choosing an HSK level as a goal may not be the best goal in the world. In fact, when my clients ask me, should I take the HSK? And these are usually people that are here in China. You know, they can already speak Chinese to a certain level and they're just thinking about the HSK. Then I usually ask them, well, do you need to take the HSK? Because there are some reasons that you might need to. For example, going to undergrad or graduate school in China, certain jobs, you need the HSK. But for most jobs, you do not need the HSK. In fact, if they really care about your Chinese level, they will test your Chinese themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, hey, you want to like know for yourself as opposed to see if they pass some arbitrary test, right?
Yeah, so that's actually what we're going to talk about today. It's the value of the HSK versus like focusing on something else. Like you might say the value of a vertical. Right, in business, you talk about a vertical, like focusing on some certain area and just going all the way up in that specialized, you know, niche, that focus.
All right, John. Well, it might help out a little bit to maybe talk a little bit about the history of the HSK.
Okay, so yeah, this is a standardized test of Chinese, obviously. Normally, when you're taking the HSK, you want to study the textbooks that directly, you know, focus on the test. Eventually, you're going to be doing practice tests. But the thing to remember is that the HSK is an academic tool, and it kind of has a bit of an emphasis on like newspaper and academic stuff because it needs to be able to test for the ability to study Chinese at an academic level, like at university or something. So it also kind of tries to cover a little bit of everything.
That's right. And I think it's important to really notice that. In fact, there's a lot of people who haven't heard of this test. I mean, it is like kind of the big test in China, but for a lot of people who haven't, you know, been exposed to this, they may not be as familiar with some of those aspects. I think that is something to note is that
this is largely developed by academics, right, inside of China. And I mean, there's varying levels, I think, of these people that might have exposure to, you know, different elements of, you know, L2 Chinese education. But it definitely has a you're right, that academic slant and slant to, like, life and specific things in China.
And one thing that I've definitely noticed about the HSK is that it tries to cover, you know, lots of different things. Like, so you got some history, you got some culture, you got some modern society. And that's all cool. That's kind of what you'd expect, right? But as the level starts getting higher and higher, like especially past HSK-4, you know, you get to HSK-5, HSK-6, it starts to get into the really difficult territory, but it kind of has these big gaps. And so you have yourself, you know, reading these really hard texts, but still being unable to read a lot of other somewhat, you know, different topic, but similarly difficult texts. And so it starts to feel a bit uneven. There is a new HSK coming out, you know, supposed to be next year or something. But for now, once you start getting to the higher levels, the academic focus feels a little weird sometimes.
Yeah, definitely. I've heard internally as well from some people who know people who've been involved in creating some of these level standards that, you know, they're aware of that. It's almost like the levels get exponentially harder, right? So going from level 4 to level 5, it's not just, you know, another level. It's like, you know, almost like double, right? But it gets really more complex. And there's been some questions internally, from what I've heard from people in the know, that they are concerned about that and how it also impacts people's progress, you know, in studying and preparing for those tests. So that's one of the reasons why they are rolling out this new HSK. Hopefully it is better and addresses some of those issues.
And you mentioned that the you know, the number of words at every level keeps doubling, and that's true. And yet with only 6 levels, if you're trying to reach like a near native level, like 6 levels isn't enough. That's not enough vocabulary. So what happens is, you know, they want this really high level vocabulary at 6, but it just kind of gives you these clumps of high level vocabulary, not this like really even all the way across really high level. So that's something to keep in mind. But if you're stopping at around HSK-4 or something, then it's much more even. Now, the question is even what you want? Like, do you really want a little bit of everything so that you can talk about, you know, all these topics at a somewhat superficial level? Or do you think it might be better to focus on something and get deeper in a certain area, but maybe to not study certain topics that you don't really need to talk about?
Yes, definitely. So this comes back to that original question of just saying, hey, should I take this HSK test? And, well, I guess it depends, right, John?
Yeah, so like I was saying, the HSK is pretty useful. Like at the very beginner level, a lot of stuff is the same. I mean, there are certain words that you just got to learn. Everyone needs to learn the numbers and times and, you know, all these words. But then once you get into 3 and 4, then the materials start to differentiate a bit. And that's also around the level where if you're in China or if you have some very specific use case for your Chinese, then you might start to feel that, you know, these HSK word lists just aren't really addressing your own needs.
It might be helpful to get an example of specifically what you're referring to, John.
Okay, so maybe at a slightly lower level, if you're in China and you like fruit, then maybe you want more practice like ordering fruit at the fruit stand and, you know, different quantities, different types of fruit. And the HSK covers that just a little bit, but maybe not enough. And so that's one area where you could go deeper, even at just an intermediate level or even an elementary level, and get a lot of reward from that because you're going to use it every day, right? Or the same thing applies to like a restaurant, maybe ordering food at a restaurant, maybe a certain kind of food, or even like maybe you're intermediate level and you're going to the gym and you want to talk about stuff in the gym. Well, the HSK doesn't really cover a whole lot of gym stuff. So if that's an area where you can actually get a lot of communication in, then you want to focus on that and not just everything else.
Absolutely. And this comes back to something, you know, we always talk about, right? Is that, hey, are you learning Chinese? Well, how are you going to use it? What context are you going to be in? And continually to focus and study and improve, on those areas. Now, obviously, it helps to have a well-rounded knowledge of the language and vocabulary and different subjects. But at that same point, you're going to know, hey, am I going to be, I'm not working, in the finance field. Is it going to help me at all to like learn different words of relating to finance and banking and things like that? So you can predict some of those things. So it's like, what are you going to be using your Chinese for?
Yeah, and actually, on the other hand, that finance example just made me think of, I've been working with a lot of people who they need to use Chinese for work. It's business. Sometimes it's finance. Sometimes it's other business meetings. And they don't even really use Chinese in a lot of the scenarios that the HSK wants them to study. So they just really want to focus on business. And, the HSK has some of that. But if that's all you want to focus on, and especially if you need to learn all the specific words in your industry, like that's a lot of vocabulary. Pretty much any industry has a big old list of vocabulary for you if you can compile it, right? And so that's another example of some people where if they make the decision to focus on something, then it makes a huge difference in their lives. And then they suddenly are using it all the time. They're hearing it all the time. And if they had just stuck with the HSK, it would not be the case.
John, I also would say that one thing I've seen about, quote unquote, business Chinese is that really often what is that there people might be in a role where it's like, hey, I need to learn Chinese for my job. But really those critical aspects of their job are often going to be done in, English in their native language. And it's because if you really needed to have Chinese for that job, you are already going to have that high level to get into there. But Chinese, number one, makes it a little easier, helps bridge over communication gaps. But especially in business, it's being able to converse with other people and just, build relationships, just talk about life, and, make a connection with a client or your colleagues, things like that. That's where I've also seen Chinese become really important in the business area.
Yeah, I've known people who, they can't participate in the business level talks, but they can, chat up the CEO of the other company about their kids because they both have kids in first grade or whatever. And that actually goes a long way in China. People really appreciate that.
Yeah, definitely. So, John, how did you go about this? Because you went to a university and studied a master's degree in linguistics in Chinese. Did you have to take the HSK? What did you do, and how did you go about approach this whole issue?
Well, Jared, fortunately, I did actually follow my own advice. So when I first came to China, I was just focused on what I wanted to talk about and, getting out there and talking to people and discovering China. But then later on, when I decided I wanted to stay in China, I wanted to study a master's in China, then I had to take the HSK. So I studied for the HSK. I passed the HSK. And then after that, I had the score I needed. But in order to get into the program that I wanted to get into, I had to pass these other tests. So then I studied for that. And, I was just focused on what I wanted to do. And unfortunately, there are a lot of tests in my story. But it did improve my Chinese a lot because I had a focus. It wasn't just that I needed to be able to pass a writing test. It's not writing about anything. It was writing about very specific, modern Chinese linguistic stuff. And I actually enjoyed learning about that stuff. So writing about it wasn't so horrible. So yeah, the focus helped me a lot.
Well, I think that's great to hear, especially the one thing I hear you saying is I enjoyed that, right? And this comes back down to hey, what is your purpose? What is your goal? And what are you even enjoying? Are you going to enjoy, learning about Chinese linguistics in Chinese, right? Or are you going to enjoy, having business conversations, right?
Yeah, so I think that is one thing that sometimes people don't even realize they're doing. They're studying a textbook which is not very well aligned with what they really want to do with their Chinese or why they started studying Chinese in the first place. And then as time goes by and they're just plodding through this boring textbook, they start to doubt their motivation for learning Chinese because they're not really accomplishing those goals or they're not able to focus on their real interests. And they don't even realize that it's the boring textbook or the course, which is not focused on their actual goals, that is sapping their motivation. So yeah, that can definitely happen.
It's important to be learning and studying something that you actually enjoy. So I think, if someone is just out there and they're just academically interested in the language. It's like, maybe I don't have any real super, you know, clear goals about how I'm going to use the language. I just enjoy learning a language. Hey, maybe the HSK is a good goal for you. It just can give you that more general rounded sense of the language. But not everyone is like that, right?
Yeah, and sometimes people, they try to focus on something, but it's not like a well-designed course of study. It's a bit haphazard. And sometimes people find that, especially in the very beginning of their studies, returning to a more structured, you know, standard course really helps them build the foundation that they can then build on top of.
That's definitely an important aspect, because a lot of times what classes and tests offer is some sort of structure, you know, a way, a disciplined, you know, steady, like you want to be doing class at this point, or you need to be hitting these certain levels and going through this different course book or whatever in order to prepare for a test. And that structure is valuable. And it can be hard to just kind of create that on your own.
Yeah, and also, Jared, I want to throw out a little metaphor, which I think has been useful for some people in kind of visualizing the differences between these two approaches. So if you think of all the language you need to learn as an inverted pyramid, right? It's a solid,
mm-hmm.
and at the bottom is the point. So that's the part that fills up the fastest. You can imagine pouring water in there, and the very beginner stage fills up really fast. But then the more you pour, and suppose you're pouring at, you know, a even rate, the slower it fills up. Now, because you're pouring water, this represents the HSK approach, where there are no gaps. You're getting everything all the way across, all the vocabulary, all the grammar, all the chungyu, all the, you know, all the topics. And it's slow going, because, you know, you got to go all the way across and the pyramid's just getting wider, right? Now, compare that. Instead of pouring water, pour sand. And you're pouring it from one point above the pyramid. And at first, it kind of just fills up like the water. But then as it starts getting higher, you start to get this little mountain. And the sides, you know, they fill up a little bit, but you have that focus. And so you have that high point, and then on the side, it's low. Like, maybe that's the stuff that you've been neglecting because you don't need it. But that high point, that's where you're focusing. That's what you can actually use. And that's what motivates you to improve your Chinese.
That makes a lot of sense. I'd also would say one thing, taking that analogy one step further for the geometrically inclined, is that upside down pyramid in Chinese is more of an obtuse as opposed to an acute angle.
I thought you were going to make a Star Wars Anakin hating sand reference. But okay.
No. Geometric, like referencing, you know, obtuse, acute angles. Come on, gotcha. Throw me a bone, John.
Gotcha. All right.
So, John, I think overall takeaway from this as well is that, hey, it's important to have a goal. It's important to have a reason to learn and study. And this, the question really is the HSK right for you? And it depends.
And is studying for the HSK right for you now, right? Because things can change, there are different stages of development, and, you know, there are a lot of factors to consider.
Definitely. And that's okay. I will say that some people I've known, they said, hey, I'm going to study for the HSK, and then halfway in or at some point, they decide, you know what, I don't want to do this anymore. I'm actually going to go study this. And there's some other people said they were studying other areas, and now they're studying for the HSK. That is totally fine. The main thing is that, are you enjoying it? Is it going to help you to get you where you want to go? Do you even know where you want to go? Do you have any goals or reasons really for learning? Because those are the underpinning questions behind this whole issue.
And some people study the HSK for a while. They get to a certain level and they're like, hey, let me try these Men or Companion graded readers. And then it's just an amazing love story. And, you know, the rest is history.
Not too shabby. All right, now it's time for a word from our sponsor, and today our sponsor is
All Set Learning HSK Mod Courses.
HSK Mod Courses? John, tell me more.
All right, so you notice I didn't just say HSK, this is HSK Mod. So what if you could take the HSK and you could modify it a bit, so it's less focused on just an exam and more focused on communication while still using the vocabulary, the grammar structures, and actually the textbook from the standard HSK. Well, that's what the HSK mod course is.
Wow, John, that sounds totally amazing. Where can I find more information about this?
All right, well, allsetlearning.com is the site, /HSK-mod. And there's lots of info about what the courses cover. They're online, one-on-one with live teachers. If you're interested, please check them out, and we'll have a link in the show notes.
Oh, yeah. All right, now it's time for rants and raves. John, what do you have for us today? Do you have a rant or do you have a rave?
I have a rant, Jared. I'm angry today.
Oh, my goodness. Let it out, John. Just let it out.
I'm talking about food again. I know I've been talking about food a lot lately. But I was out having some Chinese food with some friends. And, you know, we're in China. I eat lots of Chinese food. But they did this thing which drives me crazy. And, you know, hong shao rou, this like soy-braised pork.
Good stuff, man.
It's kind of sweet, right? They put a little sugar in it. That's normal. Well, this stuff came out, I swear, it looked like candy. Like, it was just so crazy sugared up.
What?
And I hate it when they put too much sugar and stuff. And then we ordered the eggs and tomatoes, fanjie chao dan, right? Even that was like super sweet. Like, I think that it sounds weird, but I think that a little bit of sugar in fried eggs can actually be kind of good. But this was just like sweet eggs. It was just, ugh. So,
interesting.
Yeah, that is a pet peeve of mine when they put too much sugar in the Chinese food.
Yeah, that sounds like, you know, funny enough, just the other day I made some fanjie chao dan, which is the fried egg and tomato dish, which is awesome. If you haven't made it, you should look it up. Make it. It's good. It's very easy to do. But it does, the recipe does call for a little bit of sugar. But man, that sounds like over the top.
None is also okay, but a little bit can be nice. Yeah. All right. So anyway, that's my rant. Jared, what do you got? Rant or rave?
Hey, I got a rave today. I got a rave. So I came across this just very recently. And we talk about comprehensible input all the time on this podcast, and I found this guy. He is making these videos on YouTube that is really focused on comprehensible input. Now, I gotta say that I really haven't seen any videos quite like this. And I think he knows he doesn't have it totally perfect, but is one of the best I've seen out there, and is not for like little kids. This is for like, you know, elementary learners. But the YouTube channel is called Simply Chinese. So he has only about 6 videos right now. But they talk about some really, you know, simple and easy things, and he's very repetitive. He has, you know, he's very using very simple language. He veers off here and there just slightly, but it's actually was really good. I'm like, hey, this is, like I said, one of the best things I've seen out there. He kind of models it off of another YouTube channel, another guy he actually works with who does this same thing in Spanish, and this guy's a little bit more developed in this area. But I'm like, hey, this is great. We need more things like this in Chinese for Chinese learners. So it's definitely something I would at least recommend. Have a look. And I've got a lot of that repetition using new words and things like that.
So is this for absolute beginners or beginners or?
I wouldn't say absolute beginners. He says it's for beginners. And I'm like, no, 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 no. This is not for beginners. I would say, you know, maybe elementary for sure. Early elementary. He has some videos he's talking about, like, you know, vegetable garden, you know, animals. He has one about mahjong, which he's using also like to help you learn to count and things. So I'm like, hey, you know, that's good. That's great. But this, it's not beginner stuff, right?
Not absolute beginner anyway. Maybe advanced beginner.
No. Advanced
maybe,
beginner, there
maybe
you go.
Maybe between, you know, beginner and elementary or something like that.
It's always one of those tricky things because, you know, a native speaker's like, oh, this is so easy. You know, it's like, you know, beginners. But when you get into it, no, it's not. But it goes back to that inverted pyramid, John. You know, that Chinese, that angle of incidence at the very bottom of the pyramid, upside down pyramid, it's an obtuse angle. So it takes a lot more sand to get it up.
All right. Wait, is obtuse not more than 90 degrees? I don't know how that can be more than 90 degrees, Jared.
Well, I mean, that pyramid, exactly. That's what I'm talking about. More than 90 degrees, obtuse angle. So, I mean, it's going to take a lot of sand to fill that up.
The point of a pyramid, how is that going to be more than 90 degrees?
It's a very flat pyramid, John.
All
I'm Ben Waitley. I'm founder of Memrise, language learning app.
Ben and I connected years ago, and it was great to finally bring his story to you.
I founded Memrise because I was learning Chinese myself, and it was the experiences I had while learning Chinese that made me want to create Memrise, spread those learnings out.
Perhaps you've heard or even used Memrise. They've been around since 2010 as a language learning app, but Ben's story is much deeper than any tale an app will tell. Stay with us. Ben, why did you start learning Chinese?
I studied psychology, actually, with both my co-founders at Memrise as well. And one of the things that I found was that I knew I'd been bad at learning languages. I had found it hardest to do well in exams of languages. And I found, even though I'd studied French for 10 years, when I went to France, I still couldn't speak French. Like, nothing came out. But when studying psychology and getting really interested in how the human brain learns, it's kind of apparent that the ability to pick up languages is almost our defining human trait. To be bad at the defining trait of your species, it's like being a fish that can't swim. It's just a really disappointing feeling. And where I came to on that was an understanding that it was because I'd been going about it the wrong way. And everything that I'd been taught was not the language. It was being taught the rules of the language or how to pass a language exam. And actually what I wanted was to be able to speak to people, live a life in the language, make friends, make people laugh, do the things that language is useful for. So it's quite contrary reasons for learning Chinese. When I graduated from Oxford, I thought I'll go and just put myself in a place where I'm going to learn a language, not because anyone's teaching it to me, but because my life needs me to learn that language. And I'm going to see if I am actually bad at learning languages or whether it's just the situation I've been in. So I picked a point in northeastern China, a town called Qichihar, which I chose, again, slightly contrarian reasons. The rough guide to China that I had at the time had one paragraph on Qichihar, where the first sentence was, "It's more fun to say the name of this city out loud than to spend more than an hour there." And I just thought, like, come on, you cannot just sign off a city of like 3 million people with that kind of sweeping statement. Although it is quite fun to say, to be fair to them. So I decided that there's very unlikely to be any other native English speakers there. Let's go live there, see what happens, wow. Try my luck.
What province is this in?
That's in Heilongjiang.
Oh, Heilongjiang. So, okay, you're up a little bit north there.
Harbin was the big city.
Okay, it sounds like it's going to be up there. It's probably some pretty rough winters. So what year was this? We're probably...
2004.
Okay, so we're not like robust internet days either. So there's probably not...
Yeah, see, another reason was they had a website which said that it had a language course there, but it didn't have any pages in English. So I was like, okay, there can't be very many people who are English speakers going.
Yeah.
But if I do need to find a teacher, there's something there and there's a university. The thing that I hadn't calculated was that if you are the only native English speaker in a city of a few million people for whom it is economically very important for them to speak English, you do end up with a queue of people outside the dorm room being like, can I come practice my English? Like, no, just to speak Chinese. Don't talk to me in English.
Did you have anything prearranged?
Yeah, I did email the university and got the head of international students to know that I was there and put me on a course for the first couple of weeks.
Did you enroll in a class there at the university?
At the start, I had a class there. Although, to be honest, I didn't make a huge amount of progress there. That was a book I had that helped me learn the characters. And it was so much about learning the characters, which I found kind of fascinating at the beginning, but I also found that wasn't what I wanted either. And Chinese is interesting to have something that is so separate in the spoken and written language. And my sort of theories about language acquisition were rooted in the spoken language, what Stephen Krashen calls the traditional way of learning languages, which is to live near someone who speaks another language and want to talk to them, as opposed to being taught the language. So that's what I was really there to try and road test, is like, if I just constantly put myself in the way of trying to get stuff done in Chinese, am I going to pick it up? Am I going to learn this language? The classes were about learning the characters, which I kind of fell in love with quite quickly as well, just as a practice. And actually was very big at the early days of Memrise, was really helping me to do that part of it. And to help, I created a huge amount of content on Memrise with like animated GIFs and so on to help create mnemonics for Chinese characters. But what I basically found on the spoken side was that the theory is right, that if you try and make yourself understood by people all the time in another language, need to work out what the hell they're saying in order to go about your life, you pick up the language quite quickly. And Chinese is not meaningfully harder than other languages. If that's your approach to learning the language, then it's no harder than anything else. You are just trying to make yourself understood. I guess the slightly harder thing is if you're learning French, you can guess at a few words and there's some similarity. So you get a bit faster at working out what's going on. Whereas in Chinese, there's nothing.
Yeah. I once had Steve Kaufman. He's one of those famous polyglots. And his perspective on that is like, if it's Chinese, there's no freebies. No, you got some freebies there in Spanish, you know, and French, you know, where, hey, it's pretty much the same word. We get an idea. But I think you have a really good point there. So you just threw yourself in there and say, all right, I'm just going to try to communicate. I'm just going to do the best I can, right? To get different tasks done and live your life, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's like, I remember distinctly, I used to have this pocketbook and I would write things down in the pocketbook and I'd go, okay, I've got to go and get this film developed.
Back in the film
that
days.
That dates this situation, doesn't it? And I learned all of the different like vocab and like train myself on it, repeating over and over again. They had these great tape recorders that was like a Walkman, but with a special button that just replayed the last 15 seconds. And I'd just constantly go over, I'd record myself saying the right thing or record someone saying something for me and then go back over training myself to say it at full speed. And then I have it written down in my little book. Then I'll go in, say what I had to say, and then wait for them to say something and be like, I didn't understand it. Okay. Run out again. And then come back in.
The age old problem. Like, I can ask the question, but I'm not sure I can understand the reply.
I don't know what they're saying. That technique actually of shadow reading, listening to something recorded out and then practicing it. I haven't lived in China for like 12 years. So my Chinese now is getting very, very rusty. And I went back about 5 or 6 years ago on a government trade mission for London tech companies and to go meet Chinese businesses. I knew I was going to have to talk to a lot of businesses, pitching, memorize, understanding how to talk about a tech startup, a world that I'd never been in. So I started in Qiqihar. Then I moved down to Beijing, where I set up a motorcycle restoration factory. We bought these Saikar motorcycles off the Chinese army, and then we restored them and we sent them out to the US.
Wow.
All of this was done totally in Chinese. No one on the team spoke a word of English. And my Chinese, therefore, had to get good at describing motorcycles, talking about sales, like send one motorbike over to England. And then I had to try and get it through its MOT. And the mechanic called me and said there was some problem with it. And I was trying to explain to him that there was a problem. And I didn't know what it was in English. And I was like, I've actually reached the stage where in this specific sphere, my Chinese is better than my English. Like I know nothing about motorbikes, but I can name things. And it's like, Fengjianqi is like the divide electricity machine. I think that there's a problem there. And he was like, I think it's the distributor cap. I was like,
yeah, that's not right. Yeah.
So, yeah, that thing. And he was clearly like, who is this lunatic? And it's this interesting thing that language is so domain specific. You can be totally brilliant at talking about motorcycles and have no idea at all about talking about startups. Such a difference. So I went through and I just learned these long speeches about memorizing, explaining it, and the detail of this, all this kind of shadow reading, which then when I went back out, having not spoken Chinese really at that point for 6-7 years, I was able to get back up to a speed where I could have really quite difficult conversations with people. And it's kind of bluffing, except you are actually saying it.
Yeah.
And you find little snippets that you can then deploy, and you see a conversation going to a certain place, and then you're like, oh, okay. And then you're like, and go. And sort of switch to run on that. And all of that language comes out. That's a very artificial way of doing it and a very consciously designed way of doing it. But that is kind of how language acquisition works. You get comfortable saying certain things and then they kind of flow out of you. And the more situations where you have a track that you're happy to like press play on, the better you speak the language overall.
I think that's a really good point, Ben, is that language, it's just long strings of text, and maybe you prepare and you memorize this, but it's not like it's not real language. You understand what you're saying. They understand what you're saying. That's communication. This is so true. Sometimes how opportunities find you as a foreigner there in China. So what kind of opportunities did Chinese open up for you?
When I was there, it seemed like the further north you went, the more people spoke Chinese. So the people that I knew in Hong Kong, broadly, none of them spoke any Chinese. A couple did, but not really. You went up to Shanghai, and there are a few expats living there who spoke some Chinese. Went up to Beijing, most people spoke pretty good Chinese. We went up to Chichihar. There wasn't really anyone else there. You know, it was such a small community.
Well, did Chichihar, did it live up to its supposed reputation?
It was pretty cold in the winter, I won't lie. I found it an amazing place to explore. I loved the fact that like we'd just take an overnight train out to Inner Mongolia, up to the Siberian border, and, like look over the Heilongjiang River over to Siberia on the other side. I found it amazing. It felt like I was on a different planet from where I'd grown up. So for me at the time, it was incredibly exciting and just an incredibly different perspective on the world. And I think to your question of what Chinese opened up for me, really it was just a chance to look at life from a totally different perspective. What I miss most about living in China was just that experience of every time I walked out of the door into the street and went and speak to people, something would happen that would make me think, crap, did I just make a whole load of assumptions about what it is to be alive that all of these people have not made?
Yeah.
And how many of those were truly necessary and how many of those were just assumptions that I'd grown up around were just part of my culture. And I think because the culture in Chinese is so different, it makes it easier to spot what of my own upbringing is culture and also what things then are kind of common humanity and what things are just a particular perspective. And I just found that a really interesting, a really enriching idea.
I really appreciate that perspective. There's an analogy of fish swimming in water. Fish will swim in water their whole lives, but they don't even know what water is. And that culture can be like that for us, right? That we're maybe not even aware of our own culture. You know, we're just swimming in it until you get outside your culture and you're like, whoa, this is totally different. Well, Ben, looks like you spent a lot of time there, but tell me about that path that kind of led you to starting up Memrise, because you're very involved right now in language education. So maybe you could talk about that path.
I went out there because of this kind of insight while studying how humans learn and the human mind. And then I got hooked and I spent a few years out there starting businesses, learning Chinese, making friends, making a life out there, frankly. Then two guys that I'd studied at Oxford with, Ed and Greg, we were in touch with them talking about using memory techniques for learning Chinese. They were thinking of starting this company, Memrise. And we got together to like look at how can we make this rather than just a general memorization platform? Let's apply it to a specific problem set, i.e. Chinese. And so we got together over one summer. I came back to England by that stage and we camped in Ed's parents' garden for a summer. I lived in a yurt and we built out the initial content there. And actually our very first customer, we went to the Oxford Chinese department and got the Oxford University Chinese department to start trialing it out for their new intake of students. And that was our kind of first product there in the summer of 2010. The very first thing we were doing was helping people learn Chinese characters. But the impulse behind it and the thing that we always wanted to make happen was this giving people a way to learn language through using language, not just through learning about language. And the way that I've come to think about how I was taught languages at school was that it's kind of like learning the rules of a game rather than playing the game. If you've ever got a new board game and tried to read the rules and understand what the hell's going on, you only actually work it out by like setting the board up and then saying, okay, let's play it. And you kind of play it and you're like, oh, that's what it means. Okay, I got it. And it's only by doing that that you understand the rules. And then by playing it some more, you understand the sort of strategies and what winning strategies look like and what really good play looks like. And you can learn to play games without ever reading the rules. You just start playing and someone goes, oh no, you can't move that piece like that. You move it like this. Oh, okay, cool. I got it now. Oh, and by the way, there's this thing called castling, whatever, and you can do that. You don't ever need to read the rules of chess in order to play chess. You can learn it just by playing.
It's true.
And I think it's a really good analogy because what I had learned at school was the rules of French. And in fact, certainly up to the 90s and maybe into the early 2000s at Oxford, there was a culture within the Chinese department that some of the dons there look down on people who could actually speak Chinese.
Interesting.
They would devote their whole life to studying Tang Dynasty poetry. They would be the equal of any Chinese academic on the study of Tang Dynasty poetry. But you asked them to speak Chinese? Like, no, that's a dirty language. I don't want to speak that guttural like street chat. The pure perfection of Tang Dynasty poetry is what I'm into. That's very extreme. But in a way, that's kind of what happens in language teaching at school, certainly what I did at school. We had this concept of like, oh yeah, that's grammatically correct, but no one would actually say it. But if we say it's grammatically correct, but no one would say it, the grammar is wrong. Because the point is to describe the language that people use in that country. And if your rules tell me I can say it, but no native speaker says it. Your rules are wrong. And this whole concept that we have of grammatically correct, but not used, kind of shines a spotlight on the fact that that's not how language works. Whereas there's a guy called Michael Lewis who wrote a book called The Lexical Approach. And his point is that it's probable language over possible language. Whereas grammar defines a grammarian approach, defines all the possible language, only a subset of which is actually used. You don't need that. You just need to know what the probable language is. That's what a more lexical approach is, looking at chunks of language, which actually is really great for Chinese because Chinese are also a few rules. I remember the grammar books I had where you go to the grammar section. It's like, guys, that is not a grammar rule. You do not have grammar here. That is a really basic piece of word order. I'm cool with it, but let's not call it grammar.
At least John and I on this podcast, we're definitely more of that mindset. You know, it's like, are you communicating? Do you know what you're saying? And are you being understood? And are you understanding what's being said back to you? Great. Now, yes, maybe it's great to let's improve our grammar. Let's do that, but like the actual studying of grammar has limited value. That's how I always put it.
Well, actually, another thing Michael Lewis says is that grammar explanations are useful to the extent that they are personal, partial, and provisional. If you have an explanation that says, oh, that sentence that you just learned, here's what's going on there, right there, not this is a universal grammar rule, but right there, this is what's happening. Like, okay, I get that. But if you explain it in advance, this is what happens with these types of verbs in this situation, you're just like, I don't have a mental model for this. I don't know what you're talking about. And so it can be really useful for helping clarify and codify what you've already come across.
Yes, yes.
Memorize the pedagogy there that we've been bringing into reality over the last few years. Very simply is learn, immerse, communicate. And so learn is broadly what most language apps do at the moment. It is teaching you the words, the phrases, and explaining the grammar where it's needed. And that's the kind of lean forward, learn this stuff, shoehorn it into your brain. That's what language education has been so far. I'm not saying that you don't need that, or that's not useful. You don't need it, but it is useful. Mm-hmm. It can help you move faster. Then immerse, literally the only way to develop the skill of hearing language and having meaning appear in your mind is by practicing doing it. There is no shortcut.
Yep.
I can have learned the translation for every word in the dictionary. I can have learned every grammar rule on the planet. But until I've heard people say stuff and had that moment of like, do I understand? Or maybe it means this. Does it mean that it means that? Until I've had that moment, my brain ain't going to do it. Mm-hmm. So you need to immerse to do that. And so the next part of memorize is giving people a huge amount of target language content that they'll just about understand. We know which words and phrases they've learned, so we can serve video content that uses the words and phrases that you've just used and a little bit more as well. So you have to do a little bit of working. And then there's communicate. Again, there is no way of developing the skill of wanting to express something and expressing it except by practicing. And this is a real problem for language learners, especially ones who, like me, are quite introverted and don't like going out and talking to people.
Well, you could have fooled me, by the way.
Wait, this is a one-to-one. Polyglots tend to have an incredibly good skill at going out and practicing language. They're not all extroverts, although a lot are. But you need to be able to practice that skill of expressing yourself and finding ways to do that. If you're not extroverted, the fear of being judged by other people, like you do feel really stupid. You're probably talking like a three-year-old and making more mistakes. And that's really embarrassing. And it just doesn't make you feel clever or worthy or intelligent. Mm-hmm. Anything that you normally like to be socially judged as, you don't feel like it. Memorize, the way we're addressing that is with these AI language partners. And we're leveraging this incredible technology coming out of OpenAI and other places where you can actually hold these totally realistic conversations. Whatever you throw at it, it can come back with a really realistic and accurate answer. And what that means is that wherever you are in the world, you can road test the experience of having a conversation. I had this actually in France in the summer. I was staying with my parents-in-law in France, and I needed to send some legal documents back to the UK, quite urgent.
Mm-hmm.
And I needed to go into the local post office and like ask how to do that.
Ah, the classic post office textbook scenario, right?
Post office textbook situation. And they definitely didn't speak any English in this. So I set up this situation on, we call it the Membot, this AI language partner. I practiced it like 10 times, going through with it, asking me what kind of stamps I wanted, telling me how to talk about what is first class? What do you do for an urgent letter? How do you do sign delivery? And all of these different things that I just had no way of getting to. And I went through, practiced it about 10 times, got myself so I was super comfortable with it, went into that post office, just marched up to the counter, said my piece. She said exactly what she was supposed to say. We went through it. I set off the letter and I came out, and she didn't know that if she'd moved one inch off that path, I was dead. It was just one path through the woods, and I just stayed on it.
Just like the simulations.
But this kind of simulation literally was not possible last year. And to me, this is the thing I'm most excited about in language learning, because I can see it already changing my relationship with languages that I'm not super active on learning. Like, I don't particularly have a life goal at the moment to learn French. But when it's that easy, I'm like, I'll learn to do that. Let's give it a crack. And I think that's going to be a really exciting breakthrough that we're seeing like right now.
That's amazing, because how you're describing things there is like you have a very specific use case for language, and say it was Turkish or something, it doesn't really matter. You could go in and practice and focus on that specific thing you're trying to do and hopefully function at least in that sphere and come away with a win like you did.
We call it the online motivation problem. When you're learning a language and you're in the country, you order a beer and your reward is that you get a beer. That's rewarding. When you're on a language learning app and you correctly say, you get a green tick at best. Mm-hmm. And a green tick is not as rewarding as a beer. So trying to find ways that you can make that online experience genuinely rewarding. And one of those is to make sure that you really do feel my real world ability has changed, which you don't feel when you go through a normal class. You're like, oh, I did that class. Am I going to really go out and use that in real life? Mm-hmm. Probably not. Whereas when you road test a situation like this and you go through it a few times, you're like, I got this. Then you go out and you're like, I'm actually going to do this. And I actually felt that words and phrases that I learned in that conversation in the post office in France, I was then just like using them wherever I could. I was like asking waiters about how I buy a stamp or whatever. You then start using it more and more. And it's that kind of motivation. Mm-hmm. Ways to motivate people is just such an important part.
Well, you know, at that point, the language becomes relevant. It becomes meaningful to you. So that, yeah, you have that ability to internalize it, use it, but it's useful. It's not some just academic experience.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, Ben, this sounds like really interesting. You've had a lot of experiences with language learning, and I think it's amazing how you've been able to translate some of that passion, that knowledge into a business that's viable. If you were to look back at your language learning journey, what would you change if you could, and would you do anything differently?
So I think the period that I'd most want to change is that period at school where I was subject to this kind of tyranny of passing exams being the measure of whether I could speak the language. And that huge formative period in my life where the message that I was learning was that I was bad at languages. That's really deep-seated in my psyche now. Even having gone through the experience I did learning Chinese and other languages, it's taken a long time to change that self-image. We're humans. We learn languages. That is what we do. Put yourself into a conversation in the right supportive way. You will learn the language. You literally can't help it. That is what your brain does. But that period where I thought that learning a language was about learning the grammar, a lot of polyglots do really like grammar. They're fascinated by it. But that's a self-selecting group. They are successful because the way that they learned languages at schools was successful for them because they were really into that. For the rest of us, learning grammar is not interesting or fun. Whereas communicating with people, connecting with people, laughing with people is hugely rewarding. And being able to order beers. All of these things are hugely rewarding rather than the language itself. One of my colleagues at Memrise, a guy called Rob Patterson, who speaks probably 20 languages now, I don't know.
One of those guys.
At such a rate. He said to me memorably the other day, my Hindi's not that good. I can only really speak about word etymology in Hindi. I can't really talk about much else. Which is just such a perfect exemplar of the way his mind works. Like what he needs to do in a language in order to be interested by it is talk about word etymology. Mm. I'm not very fluent on word etymology in English, but that's like the first port of call. Your mind learns what it needs to in order to solve the problem you put in front of it. I remember in the early days of Memrise finding that I was seeing characters and my fingers were starting to type the translation before I consciously knew what their meaning was. And my brain had actually created a shortcut from looking at that image to typing those letters that went faster than actually knowing what it was. You know, I'd given it the problem of type the right answer when you see that thing, and it had just optimized that problem.
Yeah, yeah.
And part of the challenge that we have in learning a language is just setting up your experience so that the problem your brain is trying to solve is how to communicate and how to understand in the language, not how to pass that exam. If you set it that task, that's what it will get really good at. And if you want to get good at speaking and understanding a language, you have to just surround yourself with speaking and understanding. There's literally no other way. Understanding has been possible for a while through watching films, through listening to the radio or whatever. But the speaking part is a bit where we're now seeing a breakthrough. That's a total paradigm change versus what's been possible previously in human history, which is cool.
You know, to highlight another analogy, reading a book about how to play guitar, you could study it inside and out, learn the different scales, where your hands are supposed to be, how to pluck the strings and everything. But that alone does not make you good at playing the guitar. You actually have to practice it, you know?
Totally. That's a better example than the game one. It's exactly right. It is actually my first Chinese textbook that they gave me. It was hilarious. It described the sound that you should make in response to each pinyin letter. And so it was like a letter, and then it said post-alveolar aspirated affricate.
Okay, right. Right.
Is there anybody on the planet who's reading that and going, oh, you mean like, sure.
Yeah, exactly.
But that hyper academicization of language is responsible, in my view, for so much of the difficulty that people have in language learning, and for the myth of people being bad at languages and people thinking, I don't have the language gene. You're speaking your native language. You do have the language gene. You're a human. What you don't have is the fascinated by grammar gene. Well, okay, that's fine. It's also interesting to know how much of a Anglophone and even North America Eurocentric problem monoglottism is. Mm-hmm. I have a friend who's from the Gambia who speaks seven languages. He doesn't consider himself a polyglot. I'm a person, like everyone I know speaks seven languages. Why would you not? Like you have to in order to communicate with people. And actually most people in the world speak more than one language.
Yeah, yep.
It's relatively rare, except if you're English American.
There's a joke. In fact, I was just sharing this last week. It's what do you call someone who speaks two languages? Bilingual. Three languages? Trilingual. One language? American. Okay. Da-da-ching. All right. Might have to cut that one out. But highlighting your point there that English is the dominant language worldwide for business and things like that. And, you know, frankly, you don't have to learn another language to be successful. In a lot of other countries, it's kind of sometimes English is seen as that language of opportunity. Unfortunately, from that perspective, though, we do miss out on a lot if we're only learning one language.
If you only express yourself in one paradigm.
That's right. Well, Ben, what advice would you give to someone who's learning Chinese right now?
So if I remember the kind of magic moment for me when learning Chinese, the point where I felt like things were falling into place and that this was actually going to be possible. Initially in Qichihar, I broadly couldn't leave because I didn't know how to buy a ticket. So I was kind of stuck there until my Chinese got good enough to be able to order a ticket out, by which time I wanted to stay. But there was a particular moment when I had this language partner called Li Shanchan, and Li Shanchan was talking. I remember really vividly the experience, hearing her saying each word, and there was like a flow of words coming out, and meaning was just appearing. And I wasn't having to do any narrative on top of like, what was she saying and what did that mean? And oh, was that word? It was just like, no, she just spoke and I knew what she was talking about. It was like, wow, this is incredible. I'm decoding it. And I think trying to get yourself as fast as possible to that moment, finding what is the shortcut to that moment, because that's where motivation just will level up again. Keep surrounding yourself with experiences that will force your brain to level up to that level. And that's two pieces of advice separately. One, if you're just starting, find that first moment where you're going to really be able to understand language. And that means exposing yourself to a lot of language content. Then go back to the learn, then go back to the immerse, then go back to learn, then go back to immerse, then go and try and do some communicate. And just moving between those three pillars of learning. Don't spend too much time on the learn. Move on to immerse, move on to communicate, because that's where you'll get the real reward, which will then stoke your motivation. If you spend too long in learning, you'll just get stuck there and you won't actually get that reward that you want. Because of my experience learning languages at school and how rubbish that was, I had this idea that we needed to change the way language education works at school and that we should focus it around giving people that experience of actually expressing themselves and being understood in another language. And it didn't terribly matter what language it was, as long as it was not the first language you spoke. And that if you have an experience in any language of being able to express yourself in something that isn't your native language and understand it, tells you what language learning is about, and you know, catch the excitement and be like, okay, I can see why this is cool. And then you can learn any language you like. There's a constructed language called Tokipona that has, I think, 113 words. It's a very small number of words, very general. All of them are positive concepts.
Uh-huh.
It was created by this lady called Sonia Lang, who wanted to have a language in which only positive concepts were possible so that she couldn't feel depressed, and said no negative narrative was possible because there weren't words for it, which is an interesting idea in itself. So what I wondered was, if you learn all 113 words in a couple of hours, which is totally possible, and then spend a few hours trying to express yourself in this language, how fast can you get from zero to actually being able to fluently express and understand yourself in that language? So we got a bunch of Memrise users to come and stay in our office for a weekend. First 2 hours of the first day, we got everyone just learning on Memrise and just learning all 113 words. And then we spent the rest of the weekend shooting videos, getting people to translate scenes from videos into Tokipona, getting people to send messages to each other, just all of this, like playing with the language.
Wow.
And what we found was, by the end of the weekend, about three quarters of people could express themselves pretty fluently in Tokipona. You can't say very precise things when you've only got 113 words.
Yeah.
But what was also interesting is that we started constructing our own grammar and constructing our own longer lexical units. So there's a word for dark and a word for small animal. So you could say a dark small animal is your word for a mouse.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not very specific. So you might want to add a couple more words on the front to make that what we all agree is a mouse.
Yeah.
And you feel that emergent grammar coming within the group, which suddenly gives you a different feeling about grammar. Because rather than the grammar being this annoying thing you need to learn, it's like, crap, if we don't have a shared understanding of, like, when we say the words in that order, we mean it that way round rather than that way round, you get confused. And so you're like, okay, let's all say that we do it this way, okay? And it's like, wow, cool, okay, we'll do it that way. And it was an amazing experience of just creating a new language, understanding from nothing. So not direct advice for someone learning Chinese, but anyone setting up language education systems, why not just try teaching people Tokipona over the course of the first couple of weeks? They would love it. They would love being able to use it as a secret code to talk behind their teacher's back. And then you get people subversively learning the language in order to annoy their teachers. It'll be awesome.
That's fantastic. I think I'm going to go out there and start learning it right away. That's really cool, Ben. Well, Ben, if people want to find out a little bit more about you or about what you're doing, where can they go?
Go to Memrise. You'll see the Learn, Immerse, Communicate tabs. Go through that and just work your way through those three and just really enjoy what's going on there, because I hope that what we've managed to produce there is exactly what I needed when I was learning Chinese. And it is the full manifestation. This technology wasn't possible really until this year. Nobody else has built anything like this yet. So it's super exciting. And I hope you'll find it incredibly useful for your Chinese stuff.
Well, thanks so much, Ben. And really appreciate your experience and all the effort you've put into, you know, developing language learning materials for so many people out there. I'm sure many people will be grateful for those. I mean, I know you've impacted already tens of thousands of lives, and there are many more yet to come.
Millions, in fact. 65 million.
Well, there we go. Okay. And the story doesn't end here. So, Ben, thanks so much for sharing your story and your experience with all of us.
Awesome. Thank you.
You have been listening to the You Can Learn Chinese podcast. Help us spread the word by sharing this with your friends, classmates, teachers, cousins, singer, athlete, sailor, therapist, sculptor, botanist, scouter, performer, and that one gal named Jacqueline. You can subscribe on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And please write us a review so we know how we're doing. You can find us on Facebook and at MannerCompanion.com, or tag us on social media, hashtag MannerCompanion. Apologies to John Cena, we just ran out of time. The You Can Learn Chinese podcast is produced by myself, Jared Turner, and our editor is Kaiser Guo. I'd like to thank our special guest, Ben Waitley, and of course, thanks to my co-host, the man, the myth, the legend, John Patterson. See you next time.